Session number 27462, Robin Richards, part 3.
Our hearts were in our mouths because we thought he probably would have been dead. But all he did was to tip his two passengers out, turn the aeroplane round, skip it back over the hedge onto the proper landing grounds, and says, "Per troppo pesante, I can only take one passenger." So the second passenger was a German officer with whom I had walked from our headquarters down to the landing ground, and who became quite chatty. But the German said to me, "It's no need for you to point your gun at me," he said. "That the war's lost." In any case, he said, "My family in Berlin has been wiped out. So, you know, I'm not going to try any funny tricks." Anyway,
well, you mentioned
Genoa was, of course, the very first occasion on which the German garrison had surrendered lock, stock and barrel to a partisan formation. And on this occasion, Colonel Stevens and the rest of us and the liaison staff piled into the such transporters as there was available and hared down into metropolitan Genoa, expecting to see that the Germans had blown off, had detonated their depth charges. Fortunately, the German commander realized that this would be a very foolish move, and it would have made the Germans extremely unpopular in that part of the world for a very long time. And in fact, you know, there was no damage done to the port. And when the operational Americans arrived up the coast road in the morning after the German surrender, we were all sitting in a Genoese hotel and eating the only food available, which was boiled eggs. That's the end of my story there, really.
You mentioned Basil Davidson and Colonel Stevens. What do you recall of those two men?
I didn't see very much of them. Stevens was a first-class officer. He was a lieutenant colonel at the time. He knew his job, certainly. Basil Davidson, although we didn't know it at the time, was a communist sympathizer of the First Water. And I think after the war, he became well known as such, though I don't think he was ever pilloried as a Russian spy. He was certainly a fellow traveller.
You mentioned earlier that you saw him in interrogating.
Yes, he was a fluent German speaker, and I remember one occasion when he was interrogating a captured German. The fellow was blindfolded and led in front of Basil, who proceeded to shout at him in very, very loud German in a very aggressive manner. And the German was shivering in his shoes, expecting to be shot any minute. But that was all.
Now, after this, what happened to you then? Did you leave SOE straight away, or did you remain in SOE to be sent out to the Far East?
I came back to London, and then I was shipped to Australia. I had a marvellous ride by flying boat from across the Atlantic, from Poole to Foynes to Iceland to Newfoundland and to Boston. We landed at all those places. It took about 4 days, I think, to cross the Atlantic. I finally got across the Pacific in a Liberator, landing at Fiji, and then in Auckland, finally in Australia. And by that time the war was winding up. In fact, in August, when the atom bombs were exploded, we were sitting in a on the north coast of Australia, in Darwin, which was then a sort of tin shanty town. I believe it's a great city now. Yes, we were still SOE, and I was told that I was going to be expected to run the submersible craft called, I think, Wellcraft, which were not real submarines. They were they were boats which could be submerged and could run at about 2 or 3 knots underwater, but they were certainly no match for the proper X-craft of the type which attacked the Tirpitz. They were much smaller. They carried cargo which was strapped in neutrally buoyant containers on deck, so that when they were offloaded at the other end, it wouldn't affect the trim of the submarine. I think the total personnel was 4, that is to say, probably 2 crew and 2 passengers. That's about the lot. Fortunately, I think they were death traps. They were designed by automobile engineers in a backyard at SOE station at Welwyn Garden City. I think they would have been highly unreliable, and very fortunately the war stopped before they could ever be used for operational purposes. So.
Did you ever go in one yourself?
Yes, we went on a practice dive in Milford Harbour. We managed to get up again, but it was all rather hazardous, I think.
So at the end of the war, was that section wound down, but you remained in the Far East, is that right?
After the end of the war in the Far East, Bob Clark and I and a crew of about 10 were allotted an Italian trawler called Eduardo, which had been sailed out from Corsica to the Far East. And we did our jobs, pottering around, taking medical supplies hither and thither, and running messages for the high command. I think on one occasion we accepted the surrender of some outlying Japanese, but my chief memory is of the extraordinary instinctive navigation of the locals. Between the island of Borneo and the island, which in those days was known as Celebes, immediately to the east, there's a 100-mile wide channel which runs north and south. And on one occasion we were in Macassar, which is the principal port of Celebes, and were bound for the oil-rich port of on the west coast of Borneo, Banjarmasin. Halfway across, we found a man in a dugout with a sail, and he made an indication that he would like a lift, please. And so we gave him a tow, and after about half an hour, he became very agitated, so we thought he'd had a stomach ache or something. We stopped and pulled him alongside, and he said, "Banjarmasin, Banjarmasin," pointing 30 degrees to starboard. Now, having more humility in those days, I did my sums again and realized I had not allowed for a 2-knot southerly current that runs down Macassar Strait. And so I very quickly took this fellow's advice and altered course 30 degrees to starboard. And in due course, our destination comes up bang on the bow in the morning. Now, that fellow, 50 miles from land, knew exactly where he was, and he knew exactly how to get to where he wanted to. He didn't have a chart, he didn't have a compass, he didn't have a watch, he didn't have any means of navigation at all. And you know, I've read all the books about instinctive navigation. There's some very fine ones written by a fellow called David Lewis, an academic who spent many months, or years I think, with the Polynesian navigators. But I still, having read all those books, I do not know by what token this fellow knew what direction to sail in by himself, no navigational aids at all, and arrive at his destination, bang on cue.